Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and in this episode, we'll be test talking with today's most well-respected testing authors and speakers, Lisa Crispin. Lisa shares with us some of her favorite agile testing techniques, including how mob testing can help your team rub out bugs one defect at a time, as well as how your team can benefit from testing group hugs. Lisa's mission is to bring joy to the software testing world and testing joy to the agile development world, and I think it really comes through in this episode. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Lisa, welcome to Test Talks.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Joe.
It's awesome to finally get you on the show. You have so much experience. So today I thought we might just focus on some random questions that I came up with from gleaning from your blogs and books.
Alrighty.
So I guess at a high level, what do you think of when someone says agile testing?
Well, mainly I just think of the mindset shift in testing going from our traditional model of, okay, the code is quote-unquote finished, and now we're going to find bugs, to preventing the bugs from occurring in the first place so that testing begins even probably before coding starts.
Awesome. I definitely agree. I think this is still, people still struggle with this. So are there any techniques that you find helpful to actually find those bugs earlier in the development lifecycle?
Well, definitely if taking a whole team approach and getting the whole team to talk about quality and what it means to them and what level of quality as a team are we committed to providing in our product. And once we've decided that, then it's a question of deciding what practices we want to try out, what experiments we want to try to make that level of quality happen. So, for example, the team I worked on before my current job was a team transitioning to Agile from, I don't even know what you would call it, complete chaos. and so we became a self-organizing Scrum team, and we talked about, you know, well, we really want a very high level of quality. It's financial services application, and it's important to people that they not lose any money, for example. And so we talked about, okay, what practices would lead us to that? Well, the first few things we thought of were test-driven development and pair programming and refactoring and continuous integration. So those felt like basics, sort of core practices we needed to master. And then once the developers had a hang of test-driven development, which is hard to learn but well worth the effort, then we decided to go up to the next level. Let's help guide our coding with customer-facing tests. So acceptance test-driven development or behavior-driven development or specification by example, whichever flavor of that appeals to you, then start also in conjunction with coding, let's start writing these higher-level acceptance tests, make them executable if possible, and let them guide coding as well as the unit-level tests. And in my experience, that really does result in much more robust code and also much more likely that you're going to build what the customer wants, because you can get together with the customers, you have your three amigos meetings with a product person, a designer, a developer, a tester, and whoever else you need, maybe an operations person or a data person, and you know, talk about the features you want to deliver and have conversations. Use techniques like example mapping that help you specify rules and examples for each story. There's a bunch of techniques out there to try, and I just feel like each team should try out whatever practices they think might work for them and see, and just keep experimenting and use retrospectives to see what's working well and what's not, and design new experiments to try.
Awesome. So it sounds like it's not a one-size-fits-all. It really is based on the company's culture, probably, and the different teams and what their preferences are.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, the risks. So if I were on a team producing, say, pacemaker software, I'd have a lot different attitude towards quality and maybe even towards things like automated regression tests than I do on, you know, currently I'm working on a project tracking tool. Of course, we want it to be good quality, but if it goes down, nobody's going to die. So, you know, it's just everything's relative and we have to focus on value to customer. And so in some cases, maybe the value to the customer is making sure there's zero risk. In other cases, value to the customer might be, let's get more and more features. And if some of them aren't perfect, that's okay. So it's just a balancing act of depending on your product and your team and your timelines and things like that.
Awesome. I hope no one from my company listens to my podcast because I always pick on them. But you brought up a great example. I actually work in an environment where our application can be audited by the FDA.
Sure.
But the management's like, oh, we're agile and we need to do things fast. But we really can't because we need to do all this extra stuff that the supposedly FDA can audit at any time. So it's almost like we're trying to say we're agile and we try to convince ourselves that we're agile, but we're really not. So I just don't know whose role do you think it is to educate the management and your team members on what exactly it is you're trying to achieve to catch risk and increase quality?
Well, first of all, people do tend to equate agile with speed, and that's not what it's about. Agile is, to use Elizabeth Hendrickson's definition, it's about delivering value frequently. So we're trying to deliver every week or every day or at least once a month at a sustainable pace. So without killing ourselves over time. And the sustainable pace is what captures all the good technical practices we need, such as continuous integration and test-driven development and those kinds of things. So a lot of teams get into trouble because they say, well, we're going to be agile now, and they expect things to speed up. But the truth is, in my experience, you're going to slow down for quite a long time, but you're going to build a platform of good code and a really good safety net of automated tests and continuous integration that's in the future will enable you to go faster. But you only get that by focusing on quality. And as far as auditing, you know, my last company, we were also subject to auditing by the financial powers that be. And what we found was we could just talk to the auditors and they would say, well, we need to see the traceability of your stories to your tests. And we'd say, well, here we have these fitness tests and they're self-documenting because, you know, they're in English and we can put comments to explain what they are. And here are the inputs and here are the outputs. And we can see that this test is passing currently because it's running several times a day. And this clearly shows the system behavior and what was tested for each new feature, and they're totally happy with that. They don't need to see an inch thick Word document with a test plan in it. So, and I've talked to people in other companies regulated by the FDA and other agencies that say that they found that too. If they sit down and talk with their auditors, a lot of times the auditors will adjust for what they're looking for as long as they get the information that they need. So I don't think there are a lot of I was just at the Agile Alliance Technical Conference a couple weeks ago, and I met a lot of people who work in regulated industries and government agencies, and they were saying that they were able to be agile and provide and make the auditors happy, provide them everything that they wanted. So that was really great to hear that there's a lot more flexibility.
That's awesome. That's great to hear. But in my opinion, once again, it's probably a culture thing. They treat the FDA like the boogeyman.
Right.
And so we have internal auditors that come in. They will ask for insane things. And if we can't meet the internal auditor's demands, they keep increasing all this complexity and all this other stuff we have to do in order to meet what they think the FDA could ask for. But it's just craziness. But
yeah, those cultural problems are, you know, it's really hard to change culture. I would recommend a book by Linda Rising and Mary Lynn Manns called More Fearless Change. And it has a bunch of patterns in it that you can use to try to affect change. And I've used it especially when I've been trying to fight a cultural issue. And I found it very helpful. It doesn't always help me succeed, but at least it helps me make good choices and try out good strategies, and a lot of times I can make a little progress. So that's just something we're all faced with, those sort of getting stuck in a culture that doesn't want to move forward. And sometimes these little patterns for change can just help us be the change agent.
Absolutely. I know previously you also mentioned how velocity, how agile doesn't equate to fast. Your velocity may slow down. And
right.
that's another struggle I've seen teams involved with. I've even had managers say, well, I don't want developers even thinking about any sort of testing. They're rock star developers. I just want them coding. And I thought I was like back in the 90s in a cubicle. And so I guess my point is, who should be testing nowadays in an agile environment? Is it a person's responsibility, or is it really a whole team effort like you mentioned earlier?
Well, and again, it's one of those questions where it depends. But I think in the majority of cases that I've seen, I think it's usually good to try to have experienced testers on the team, people with testing skills in areas such as exploratory testing that developers may not have. And I definitely think they should be part of the team. I have seen cases where it made sense to have a separate test team. For example, with embedded software, sometimes the development team does not have access to all of the actual devices that they need to test with. They're using emulators or simulators, and they can't do the end-to-end testing. And so in that case, it might make sense for a separate team that works closely with the developer team, but is a separate team. But in general, you need to test as you go. Another issue, though, is, in my experience, it's also very difficult to find the testers with the right kind of attitude and mindset to work on an agile team. It really takes such a mindset shift, and it's hard to find those people. And it's hard to find people who are great exploratory testers and at the same time have the technical awareness to be able to collaborate easily with the technical team members. And that's you have communication issues. And so since it's hard to hire appropriate people, a lot of teams are finding they don't have enough testers. What do they do? And so what I'm seeing is they're using those testers to train the developers and transfer those good testing skills. So pair with the developers, sometimes even pairing with the developers to write production code, and at the same time, teach them how to write testing charters, teach them exploratory testing. Make sure that they're covering adequate test cases with their automated tests. Help them with things like driving development with customer-facing tests, like behavior-driven development, that sort of thing. And that's the route my team is taking right now because, we just hired another tester. So we now have three testers for a team of 30 developers. It's really not enough. So we're experimenting with each developer pair, and our team does 100% pairing. They do test-driven development. We're also doing behavior-driven development. And so they're writing cucumber tests to capture the more end-to-end scenarios. And so they do those, and they do exploratory testing on that story before they call it finished. And then we testers, we can't possibly test every single story. So we do testing charters at the feature or epic level. And so we're testing more layers, and we're probably going to find issues they couldn't find by focusing on one story. But it's still an experiment. I'm seeing areas, sometimes it's successful. Sometimes I worry that the feedback loop is getting too long because we can't do that exploratory testing at a feature or epic level until a critical mass of that epic has been done. So that's a little longer feedback loop. At the same time, until all of those stories are done, you don't have all those layers in there to test. So I think it's just a question of experimenting, because I know other teams where this model is working very well. And I think it just depends, again, on your product. If it's a product, if it's a domain that developers understand, they're going to be able to do a better job of testing it.
Great. So you mentioned that there's so few testers on your team. And I've seen the same thing, especially in agile teams. For some reason, most sprint teams have more developers than testers. So it sounds like if we use behavior-driven development, we can kind of help guide developers to test their code as they go along, because at some point we just don't have the capacity to do all the testing. So have you seen that as a change from where we used to do things back maybe in 2000, in the 2000s, that now we really is, everyone is involved in testing, and it has to be involved in testing just for that mere fact?
Oh, I think it's certainly a change from the more chaotic teams I was on, like in the 90s. But on the other hand, I was on a waterfall team in the early 90s where the developers, they actually wrote unit test plans, which I think was going a little far.
Wow.
But they didn't do test-driven development, but they did automate all of their unit tests. We had continuous integration. We had automated deployments. We had a big enough test team that we were able to do all the exploratory testing and automate sufficient UI testing, and worked great. And yeah, we only delivered every 6 months to a year, but that was fine for our product. So I don't think it really matters if you're waterfall or agile, but I think it is important for everyone to get involved in the testing. And I've always gotten involved from day one of every project, even when I was on a waterfall team. You know, back in the day when we had a requirements phase, I tested the requirements. So, you know, it was really important to ask questions at those early stages and make sure we're going down the right path and make sure that we understand what's the value that we're giving the customer. Is this really what they want? I think that's always true, but I do think because of Agile, I think we have a lot more programmers who are quote unquote test infected or test obsessed, and they understand the value of quality and they understand the value of testing, and they're much more open to it. Certainly developers I've worked with for the past 10 years are totally, well, even the past 15 years generally, are totally on board with it and willing to do the task. Now, that said, sometimes they don't want to do some of the tester activities. I feel like one of the ways I add value is in talking to our product owner and our stakeholders and trying to understand what it is they want, or trying to help them articulate, you know, what are the business roles? Give us some examples of desired behavior. Give us some examples of undesired behavior. And asking the interesting questions, thinking of all the dimensions of quality, all the dimensions of the product. I think that's one thing where testers and also business analysts and people with similar skill sets can add value. And a lot of the programmers I've worked with are uncomfortable doing that. They're happy to sit in a room with someone facilitating that conversation, but if it were just them and the customer, they would have a hard time. So I think generally programmers are willing to take on just about any testing activity, but there are some they're more happy with. They're happy to automate tests because that's really just coding. Specifying the test, though, they may not feel like they are going to think of, you know, maybe they can think of the happy path test, but not the boundary conditions or the sad paths and things like that. They don't think that way. They're programmers have to be optimistic. They don't necessarily think of the negative things. So that's why I think we do need all these different perspectives on a team. We need the diversity of different skill sets and different types of experience.
Absolutely. And can you share some ways, or do you know of some ways that teams can build and share expertise in testing?
One of the things I do is, well, like pairing is a big one. I think something new that I would like to do more of, I've just started learning about it and trying it, is mob testing. Now, mob programming is becoming more popular, where you have more than a pair. You have a group of developers and you time box it and rotate positions. So someone's at the keyboard driving, somebody's the navigator, and then the rest of the people are just contributing however they see fit, and then you switch every 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever it is. You can apply that to testing too. And so you can do testing with a group of people. I found that's an interesting way to help people get experience. Pairing, obviously, is a great way to transfer skills. And on my team, we do something we call them group hugs. So if we've got a new feature that maybe we think is ready to go out to beta, we'll get a bunch of volunteers from the team, and maybe developers, product owners, designers, as well as testers. And we'll get in a room together, or that might be virtually or actual physical room. And we'll have charters. And so people will pair up on charters and do some exploratory testing. And we're all in a room together so we can talk. It's like, hey, did anybody notice this behavior? And we, you know, we keep notes of what we find, what we try, and what we find. And that just gives everybody a feel for, oh, I didn't think of trying that. That's a great thing to try. I'm going to remember that next time. Just a great way of not only bringing a bunch of perspectives together so that you come up with better ideas, but also just that kind of sticks with people of, oh, wow, you know, it's really important to test these different heuristics. One of the things I did recently, I got this idea at the AATC conference week before last, is somebody who was talking about how to transfer testing skills to developers said she laminated some heuristic cheat sheets and just left them lying around the workstations. And because they were shiny and laminated, people picked them up. And I was like, that's a great idea. So I printed off some copies of Elizabeth Hendrickson's testing heuristics cheat sheet and laminated them. And I've left them around the workstations. And I have noticed people picking them up. So we'll see if that has any effect. But I also do, you know, at our company, we every Wednesday we have a tech talk, and so the company buys lunch and somebody can get up and give a talk. And so I signed up to do that, but instead of a talk, I did an exploratory testing workshop where I taught them how to write a charter using Elizabeth Hendrickson's template from her book Explore It. And then I brought a bunch of little toys and little games and things, and I said, you know, just pick a game or a toy and write some charters for exploring it. And, you know, use your personas. I told them about personas as well. And do exploratory testing. Try out, you know, do some exploring based on your charter. And they had a great time with it because they were playing with toys and stuff. They said it really helped them understand better about, you know, how you would apply that to testing software as well. So I think there are a lot of different ways that you can encourage people to sharpen their skills.
Awesome. Yeah, those are all great tips. And I think you actually came up with the title for this episode, Mob Testing. maybe because I'm Italian, that really resonated with me. Mob testing, rubbing out bugs or something. So that's awesome.
Well, it's not my original idea, but I like to pick up other people's ideas and try them out. And the person I learned that from is Mara, and I can't pronounce her last name, Pihavari. She's from Finland, and she's co-written a book on mob programming with Llewellyn Falco, but she also applies that to testing, and it's been really fun to try it out.
Awesome. So you've written two books on Agile Testing and More Agile Testing.
Actually, I've written three. I co-wrote Testing Extreme Programming back in 2001 with Tip House, and then Agile Testing and More Agile Testing with Janet Gregory.
Awesome. So are there any chapters in those books that you think are misunderstood or you think people didn't understand what the point you were trying to get across? Any concepts you think really would help the community to relook at maybe?
Well, actually, we've got pretty much nothing but good feedback on Agile Testing and More Agile Testing. People have said it's really helpful. And what people like the best is we've got so many stories in there from contributors, you know, who are practitioners with different specialties in testing and in different domains around the world. And I think people learn really well when they read a story of, oh, these people are doing what I'm doing and they had the same problem. What do they do to fix it? It can really give you ideas. So like in More Agile Testing, we have people sharing stories of how they tested embedded software or how they tested in a big enterprise company or how they tested data warehouse. And so, yeah, I haven't had any pushback saying, well, I don't really get this concept. Some people have not really liked our agile testing quadrants, which we adapted from Brian Merritt with his permission, but that's just a model. And that's how we use the model. We encourage people to take the model and make it work for them. Of course, you need to apply it to your situation. So change it, make it work for you. I did have a lot of misunderstanding on the first book I co-wrote because people tended to look at that one chapter and not read anything else. And back in the early days of extreme programming, there was a lot of test-driven development at the unit level, but not so much at the acceptance level. People were not automating tests above the unit level, which is really a problem because you need those regression tests at the API level and at something at the UI level. You don't want to always have to do everything manually. And so we had a chapter on manual testing and tried to make a point. The chapter said no manual testing. And then the next chapter was entitled What? And in that chapter, we explained that we mean no manual regression testing, that we need to have time for exploratory testing. So we need to automate all the regression tests. Unfortunately, people didn't necessarily keep reading, and they got mad at us because they said, well, you're saying not to do any manual testing, and that's bad. And yeah, that's right. And, you know, if I could go back and redo that book, I probably would not try to make my point that way. On the other hand, I feel like no, I don't know if it was a result of our book necessarily, but I know a lot of XP leaders at the time were saying, yes, we have to automate acceptance tests as well. This is something we have to do. So start by assuming you're going to automate it. And then if there's some reason not to automate it, then don't. But start with the assumption you're going to automate it. And I think that helped a lot of teams get over the hump of doing something that was really hard, starting to automate their acceptance tests, because they felt like, well, okay, that's just something we have to do if we're doing extreme programming. And sometimes I think you have to make a bit of an arbitrary rule to goad people into doing it. And then once they've learned how to do it and gotten over that hump of learning, then they can adapt and apply it where it's appropriate instead of using it as an excuse. Just like, well, I don't necessarily have to do this because there's nothing wrong with manual testing.
Absolutely. Awesome. Great advice. You also recently blogged about how to get more women presenting at software conferences, and this is actually how I got you on the show finally. So why do you think in 2016 this is still an issue, especially in the testing community? I've worked with so many great leaders that happen to be women, developers and testers in my career. So why do you think this is still an issue?
Well, I've been puzzling over that a long time, but I think what Marat said in her blog and what some other people have said has a lot of truth to it. I don't believe that any of these conference organizers are doing it on purpose. They're not intentionally slighting women, but they're men and they happen to know more men. And so that's who they end up inviting. And if you go to conferences, I was at Test Bash in March in Brighton, England, which is a wonderful conference. And there are easily equal numbers of men and women both speaking and attending. But when you go to the pub afterwards, the men are tending to group into a group into groups, and the women are tending to group into groups. And this is probably just natural human behavior. So we tend to congregate with people that are more like us, right? Perhaps. And I happen to know a lot of women. So when I was on the program committee for the Agile Alliance Tech Conference, and of course I kept thinking of women to invite, which I wanted to do. And we all of us on the program committee wanted a diverse lineup. But I think we have to just pay attention to our biases. Our brains have biases built in, and we have to fight them all the time. And it is, I think women are less confident. Most of the women that I asked to come and speak say, well, I don't really have any experience that everybody has the same experience I have. I don't have anything new to share. Well, you don't have to have anything new. You have to have your experience, which is unique. And how you overcame a particular testing problem or what experiments your team tried, other people do want to hear that. But speaking is hard, and it takes a lot of extra effort. And to encourage these women and convince them that it's worth it, the reason I speak at conferences is so I can go to conferences to learn. I don't feel comfortable presenting at conferences. I've gotten competent at it over the years by working very hard at it and learning a lot about how people learn setting up learning experiences where they can learn things themselves. But my motivation is to get to the conference so I can learn myself and bring ideas back to my team and meet a lot of fantastic people, because when you have a big network of people and you have a problem, then you usually know somebody who might know the answer. So it takes extra work. And conferences, Agile Testing Days, I know the organizers, because I've helped them, they go through a lot of extra effort to try to find women speakers and to offer, even they compensate lightning talk speakers to try to get more new speakers and more women to try it. And even with that, they're only getting about a 30% women submission rate on their proposals. So it's hard. It's tough. But we just need to keep working at it, and we'll make progress. I'm seeing progress now. I really feel like we're turning the corner on this.
Awesome. I think you've brought up a good point. Maybe a lot of people aren't conscious of what's going on, their biases. Mm-hmm. It may not even be a bias. Like, I looked at my previous, I have almost 100 episodes now, and I'm thinking, my male to female ratio is pretty skewed. And and I don't know why. I randomly select topics, and I look at authors. I don't even know their nationalities or anything, but it just turned out that maybe it is something I need to be a little more conscious of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've asked people, the other people who do podcasts, and they said, well, anybody can ask to be on the show.
Yes.
And it's like, you know what? We women are not going to ask. We're waiting to be invited. And so there's a two-way thing. We need to ask more, and then maybe other people need to invite more.
Absolutely. Okay, Lisa, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their agile testing efforts? and let us know the best way to find or contact you.
I would say think of your biggest testing problem and take it to your whole team, your whole delivery team, and say, we've got this testing problem. Can you help me think of experiments to make this problem smaller? My website is lisacrispin.com, and I'm Lisa Crispin on Twitter. And my email is lisa@lisacrispin.com. I've tried to make it really simple.
Nice. Thank you, Lisa, for your agile testing awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we covered in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/101. And while you're there, make sure to click on the Sign Up Now free button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.